Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. I'm Blake Oliver.
And I'm David Leary.
And we are joined today by Charles Bedard. He is a M&A corporate development advisor, and we're going to talk about firm valuations, specifically the difference between subscription firms and traditional firms. And this is something I'm very eager to discuss because I have always heard that subscription firms get much higher multiples when they sell, but I've never really quantified it. We've never really discussed exactly what that means. So let's talk about it.
And I've heard it's not just firms. I mean, this is why companies like Intuit, I remember when they're making that transition from the old desktop days to cloud, one of the arguments is the valuations of SaaS subscriptions and having subscription-based businesses, you're on Wall Street, right?
Your
actual valuation is worth more so.
Yeah,
not just firms.
With software as a service businesses, it's all about that recurring revenue. And that's why you get 10x, 20x your recurring revenue or more even. And I believe the same thing can happen with accounting firms. So let's talk with Charles. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So before we talk about these valuations, you know, give us a little bit of background. Why are you the guy to talk to about this today?
Absolutely. So I'm an M&A corporate development advisor. I work exclusively with work tech and B2B tech-enabled services across the country. Been doing that for the last 20 years. I've worked at all stages from startups and small businesses to venture-backed to private equity-backed family office and sold some companies to some public companies last year. I've worked at all classes and I've interviewed a couple hundred people that run practices or professional service firms every year for the past decade and provide a number of corporate development strategies for firms like this.
So let's get to it. Let's just talk the numbers, right? What is the difference between a firm that has embraced subscription pricing and billing versus one that is on a traditional after the fact hourly billing model? Can we quantify the difference in the valuation when a firm goes to sell?
Yeah, absolutely. The short answer is for subscription firms, and the good news is there's a lot more buyers, so there's a lot more options. For subscription firms, it's not just limited to other CPA firm mergers or other CPA firms industry consolidation. You've got professional service firms. You've now got these private equity backed firms. You've got other BPOs. You've got other solution providers that are doing outsourced cloud accounting or even outsourced tax services that are not traditional CPA firms. So you've got a lot more options if you're a subscription, because as you all alluded to, it's easier for the non-CPA firms to value subscription recurring revenues because that's what their models are set up to do. So you got a lot more options. So, you know, for CPA firms today, the good news is if you have a subscription model, you got a lot of different types of buyers and more options.
So when you say a lot more buyers, what's the difference we're talking about?
CPA firms, if you look right at the top 400 firms, everybody below that is below 10 million in revenue. So below that top 400, you're looking at largely being limited to SBA lending or management buyouts or employee ESOPs, those kind of options. So you're limiting your total valuation, which I'm sure we'll get into in a second, and you're limiting your options. Of those CPA firms, only about the top 100 have proactive full-time corporate development people that are out there looking. So you might do, those next 300 might do one or two deals every 5 or 10 years as part of their natural progression. But it's a limited space within the CPA world. So it's probably 100 serial repeat buyers that are traditional CPA firms versus a couple hundred additional non-CPA buyers. Plus you've now got the 65 private equity backed investors that are in the space, another 24 alternative investors that are looking to make investments, as well as globals and other people in the space as well.
Got it.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, traditional accounting firm buyers are kind of okay with possibly buying a firm that's not subscriptions based, but externally, the bigger market of buyers in general doesn't want to touch a non-accounting firm or an accounting firm that's not subscription based.
They'll definitely look at it, but you're not going to get as a premium valuation if they can't translate it to their subscription. So if you can do the recasted financials to make it easy for them to look at the business based on the number of tax returns or the number of professional employees, if you can recast that and correlate that to how they're looking at subscription, then yeah, there's a number of people that are actively looking at those firms because they think they can buy them at a discount because they haven't gone through the work to do the translation to looking like a subscription or recurring business. Even though the business may, even though those revenues may actually look recurring, on average, they're typically going to get a little bit of a discount compared to somebody that's done the work to tell the recurring subscription story.
So let's talk about that valuation then. What is the difference?
Well, the good news is, you know, so two parts. The good news is the accounting firms have a wide range of value. And I believe that the modern digital CPA firms are undervalued. They're undervalued historically compared to other functional professional services firms. And I believe for your modern digital firms, that's actually going to change this decade. We started seeing it change over the last few years, and I think we'll continue to see that. So for the modern digital firms, I think you'll see them being worth more than your traditional B2B service firms. But historically, if you look at it, the average CPA firm, small business, private, pre-institutional, was worth less than a marketing agency. It was worth less than a payroll firm. So it was worth less than the sum of its parts because these CPA firms were focused on building their practices, not focused on creating exit value or building businesses. So I believe this dynamic will change over the next few years where modern firms will be, you know, valued more than your outsourcing your payroll firms. So the range of value depends on the buyer, right? Each buyer has a different set of metrics that they look at, but the valuation ranges, you know, depend on, are you perceived as a traditional services model or are you perceived as a modern digital model? And so that valuation range, you know, from revenue multiples can be the difference between being worth 0.3, 0.4 revenue multiple to the historical average of 0.8 to 1.5 to more. And on the EBITDA or adjusted earnings side can be anywhere from 3 times up to 8 or 10 times or higher, you know, and there's deals that transact for higher than that if they're market leader, category leader, niche leader, geography leader. So there's a wide range of value. And that's not the case and won't be likely be the case long term. If you look at other comparable industries, they do not have the same range of value qualities. It's not the case in HR. It's not the case in legal. It's not the case in other functions. So there's this window, let's call it 2021 to 2029, where CPA firms can kind of make the determination, do they want to go through the effort to be considered a modern firm? Then they're going to be worth 1.5 to 2 times more revenue and 7, 8, 9, 10 times EBITDA. If they don't, then their valuations probably are going to decline, all other things being equal, for the next few years.
That is quite a spread. So if I heard you correctly, on the low end, a traditional firm might only get 30 or 40% of their annual revenue when they sell. Yep. On the higher end, a subscription firm could get 150%, 200%, or more.
Yep. I've done deals in the last 2 years at both those. I took the same company to market last year. Let's call it a $10 million firm to make the math simple. From a traditional CPA firm, we got one offer at 3 times earnings. We got an offer for 3 times earning plus a really attractive earnout incentive stock. We got an offer for 1.5 times from an outsourced non-CPA QBO provider. We got offer for a 1.8 from an offshore BPO. Same firm, same financial profile, same history.
Wow.
4 very distinct offers financially and terms wise as well. So it's not just about the valuation, but
right,
yes.
How long you're going to have to stick around, how quickly you're going to get paid out, are there clawbacks? All that is really important because that can add to or detract from that big number that you're seeing.
Yeah, I think you saw, like, you know, the traditional 4-year buyout from CPA firms, those that were worthy of being being private equity bought out, that went to 2 or 1 or nothing, you know, between 2020 and today, right? So you still have your CPA firms that some of them are now offering 2-year earnouts. A lot of them are still offering the 4-year or the partner track like has historically been the model. But majority of these private equity backed ones, they'll apply some stock and some roll forwards. I don't want to say it's a 1 year or less. But certainly from a percentage basis looks very differently to the take home pay for the partners.
So you've used this term modern firm about a couple times during the interview here. So are the valuations truly just because they have a subscription model, or is it because that's a leading indicator? Like, hey, if they have a subscription model, they probably also have really good processes, and the owner is not in the business. He or she's been running the business. Like, is that really the bigger indication? Or how do you even, maybe the better question is, how do you define a modern firm?
Or digital firm was the term also used, right?
Yeah. So I think we've, I've been talking to CPAs for a long time. My dad's a CPA. And, I heard all last decade and during the aughts that firms weren't going to standardize. Everybody's going to have a different GL process. And, fast forward and with Sage Intacct and NetSuite and QBO and these other standardized digital solutions, I think we are seeing standardization. And now we're seeing, tech enablement at different levels, but it's clearly out there. Even very small firms are tech enabled or can be. And so I think I would define it as you have your traditional hourly billing services based firm. You've got your tech enabled firms that are more profitable, digital, standardized, probably specialized in some practice areas and niche. And then I think you've even got, the leaders, which I would call 3.0 firms, which have their own proprietary technology in addition to being tech enabled. So I think there's a wide spectrum of firms. There's probably 40,000 CPA firms on the 1.0 level, a few thousand at the 2.0 level, and maybe 100 to 200 on their way to being a 3.0 model.
All listeners of the Accounting Podcast, of course.
Absolutely.
I want to get back to the valuations, because you mentioned two different ways of valuing firms. We've got a multiple of top line revenue or recurring revenue, and that's where we got that 0.3, 0.4, all the way up to 1.5, 2x or more. You take the annual revenue of the firm and you just multiply it by that. We call it a multiple. Or at least that's what I've heard it described as. Then you also have another multiple, which is larger, which is based on EBITDA or earnings. Who is more likely to use that? Is that the private equity folks that like to use EBITDA?
Yeah, historically, your financial buyers, your investor buyers, their models are largely driven by EBITDA. They will take into consideration other factors. If the company's outperforming on number of tax returns per partner or revenue per professional, they'll take those into account, and they'll push that from being an average EBITDA multiple up to a premium. So they'll take those other metrics and factors into consideration, but the EBITDA is going to give them a range of which they can afford through the transaction. And then all that other stuff, which is equally important, if not more important than the EBITDA, is going to go into where do they fall on that EBITDA range. So that EBITDA is going to give them the range, or as the investment bankers would call it, the football field we're allowed to play in. And then all that other culture, the team, the quality of the contracts, the quality of the customer base, the amount invested into the IP, all those other assets are going to influence where they fall in that range.
And for a modern or digital firm, what is the range of EBITDA multiples you're seeing?
We saw an all-time high in 21, a little bit more structure to get to that valuation in 22, a little bit even more structure in 23 than to get to 22. 24, it's looking bullish, but and early indicators are for if they're private pre-funding, you're looking at 4 to 6 on the low end, up to 6 to 8. And if you're a true market leader, category leader, 8 to 10, could be even 10 plus structure, look like more than that at the end. So that range, I would say, is kind of, it's not just the subscription model. It's also from the buyer's perspective, are you, premium top one or two in your category or niche or geography, and what other options there are. So that kind of plays into it. But yeah, once, 4 to 8 is the ballpark, and then we're debating how much is upfront versus structure.
Okay, so this makes sense because I'm trying to compare this top line revenue multiple versus earnings multiple, and it really seems to come out kind of the same in the end, right? Because if a typical CPA firm is what they can be 20% profit, right? Drive 20% profits or 10-20%, then if you are doing an EBITDA multiple of, let's say, 5 to 10 times, that gets you to that 1.5 to 2x on the revenue. Am I saying it right? Like it's different ways of thinking about it. I guess flip side of the coin.
There is, and that's why, you know, to give listeners something actionable, I think the most common metric, it really didn't exist before 2020, but I believe the most common metric used in the investment banking and investor world today is what I call R value, but it came to be known as Rule of 40, which is it's a simple formula, but it's year over year revenue growth, typically looked at over a 2 or 3 year period as an average. The R value is typically looked at over a 2 or 3 year average period, not just a single point in time, but it's the metric is year over year revenue growth plus your EBITDA percentage. Together, those to be a premium when it was created, this Rule of 40 was you need to be over 40 for those two together. What that metric does is it takes away, are you running the business for revenue and selling it to somebody who's going to buy on revenue, or are you running it based on EBITDA and selling it to EBITDA? It normalizes all the different types of buyers. So if I was a CPA partner or owner, and I wanted to have one metric to think about, to if I'm creating value, I'd look at R value because that's going to normalize that. And then you can always recast the financials or make the case that your revenue or your EBITDA is higher or lower.
And how do I calculate the R value? You said that's my growth rate?
Year over year growth rate plus your EBITDA percentage. So if you're growing at 10% year over year and you've got a 20% EBITDA, you're at 30. So you're a little bit below 40.
Got it.
You're growing at 50, like a lot of these high flying SaaS companies, but you've got negative earnings, then let's say it's negative 10% earnings, then you're back at 40 if you're growing at 50 with negative 10% earnings. So it takes into account where the company is at in its maturity and its life cycle and normalize it across buyer types.
And 40 is the target?
40 was the target, if you just Google it, when it was first published and used by VC firms. Today, if you're a software firm, you really need to be 70, 80, 90, your early stage. I think for any accounting firm listener, you know, 40 is a great goal. You know, start with 30, build from there, get to 40. 30 is good. 40 is getting you to where you want to be and driving, starting to get in the range of driving a premium.
So let's say I've got a decent R value. My growth is good. My earnings are good. I imagine there's a minimum size I've got to be in order to be in the game to get interest from buyers. What should I be targeting for minimum revenue, headcount, however else buyers look at firms?
Yeah, if you look at, I'll give it to you three ways. If you look at Inc. 5000 top performers for the last 10 years within service companies, the average has gone from 171,000 revenue per full-time employee to greater than 250,000 revenue per full-time employee. So if you're not keeping up with that, you're falling behind. So that means, yes, you need to offshore more or use contractors or use tech enablement or bots. So I think that revenue per FTE is just a good overall, you know, metric. In terms of size, if you look at the average investment by SBIC or by private equity, it's increased over the years. When I was doing this a decade ago, they would look at stuff below 2 million in EBITDA. Today, it's very difficult for them to look at anything below 2 or 3 million in EBITDA. So that's kind of your size metric. You know, there's some other types of buyers that are not private equity, but that general.
So to get private equity interest, sounds like I need to be doing about 10 million or more in revenue for most firms. Would you agree?
as a platform, you know, they can look at a smaller deal if it, if you're the niche leader, you know, if you're an add-on or a tuck-in and they have already invested in and they are, or they already have a platform and you're going to add an Intact practice, or you're going to add San Diego, which was a deal that was announced this week, or you're going to, you know, add CAS practice or some specialty, then they can look at doing some smaller deals. But yeah, for the, but for the majority of the deals that they've done, they're looking at two or three. And in fact, you know, you go to the private equity conferences, they want to look, they want to talk to people that have 4, 5, 8 million in EBITDA. So,
yeah. So I have a firm, I remember using an analogy of a house. I'm ready to sell my house. And there's a list of things I should do to increase the value of my house. And I get an ROI on that. And there's things I'm not. Can you give a list for accounting firm owners, what they should be doing in their firm and what should they not spend time doing in their firm to maximize their exit potentially?
Yeah, it's a great.
And I'm going to add to David what David said. Uh-huh. Sorry to interrupt. But I'm going to say, like, let's assume that this firm is traditional. So they are billing hourly after the fact. They are doing a mix of services. You know, let's say it's tax and accounting and bookkeeping. Maybe they got some audit in there, right? But it's mainly like traditional. So like, yeah, where do I get the quick wins?
Yeah, absolutely. So I like to tell people, if you want to create wealth and value from your practice, then corporate development is as important as business development or service quality, meaning you have to know and have a plan for exit and wealth. We'll work with people and develop 2-year rolling plans that adjust. We'll give them a few key metrics that they should follow. And we'll have a general idea of we're going to steer the business towards this direction. It can change, but we're going to have a plan. So I think that's the most important thing. If you wait till the end, you're not going to capitalize on all the opportunities. And there's so many opportunities out there for traditional CPA firms today. They could divest part of the business. They could do a small acqui-hire. They could merge with somebody else. I mean, there's just so many opportunities today for these traditional businesses. I've got a guy down in Texas who's bought and sold 5 small practices. He buys them up, puts them together, and then divest them. But he's basically taking books and creating these niches and doing it. But there's just so many options for these traditional service firms. So I'd say, you know, number one thing, if you're going to do nothing else, is understand where you're steering your exit. Don't wait 5 years. Don't wait. Don't be an ostrich and put your head in the sand. You know, if you want to buy a beach house down the road, have a plan of how much you need to make to get there. So I think that's the first thing. And then I'd say you can rank. If you talk to a bunch of advisors, they're going to give you a different list. I rank all the things you could do into 2 categories: protect the business and protect the minimum valuation, or build the valuation. So at a minimum, there's some things you can do to protect the valuation, and there's some things you can do to build the valuation. At a minimum, to David's point, you know, understand how your financials look to a third party. You know, I definitely tell people all the time that accountants and shoemakers shoe effect. They haven't had a third party look at their own book. You know, they're managing them for tax, or they're managing them when they get to them. So, you know, there's a number of things you can do to protect the valuation and just demonstrate that we're the best version of ourselves as a traditional firm. You know, do some basic benchmarking. I'm happy to provide a free consultation, 30-minute session on benchmarking. AICPA provides benchmarking. There's a lot of benchmarking groups that are out there. But get a benchmark, understand where you're at. Do a few things to protect your IP. Those are just standard things that you can do to, you know, get a traditional valuation. But I think, you know, have a plan.
On the opposite side, do you see like people heading down wrong paths? They think that's the path and they start implementing things that are not going to help them get a better valuation, like mistakes, if you want to think of it that way?
Most firms don't exit for a premium because they're not thinking about exiting for a premium. They're just thinking about running their practice. So, you know, what are the most common mistakes? I think firms all the time make investments that they heard about at Vistage, or they read about on CNBC, like, I'm going to go hire salespeople, or I'm going to spend more on training and development to keep my people. I think firms make decisions all the time. And based, if they're a 40-year-old owner, maybe that's a good decision. If they're not, if they're 64 and they're going to go add Intact because they hear that's the next big thing so that they can land some bigger accounts because they hear that's what CPA firms want. If you're 64 and you're retiring in the next year or two, you're probably never going to get the payback on that, right? So I think you've got to know where your exit is coming and where you're steering the business. So I think a lot of these investments in both money and time are not tied to actually increasing the value. So yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the efforts that people take because they're not tying it back to the game plan are not bad for the employees or the customers, but they're not creating wealth or value for the entity.
I tell people all the time, and I'm curious to hear, Charles, if you think this is a good strategy. I tell people all the time that the simplest thing you can do is to not change anything that you do in terms of the services in your firm. But, you know, let's say you're doing a bunch of tax returns. It is to switch your clients to upfront billing for the returns and get 100% upfront if you can and put them on a recurring billing structure. You don't have to do anything else. And if you do that, you'll recapture all that working capital that you've essentially loaned out to your clients every tax season.
You could have them pay up front. You can have them pay on an annual basis and give them discounts if they lock in their rate over a 2 or 3 year contract, which is a very common software strategy. You can announce price increases that are increasing in the future for the smaller or less profitable accounts. I think there's so many things you can do to increase the value without having to spend a lot of money. Absolutely.
So the lesson here is don't get distracted by implementing some sort of new technology in your firm before you actually fix the, what would you even call it? It's like the billing structure or just the way you work with customers, because that's actually fairly easy to do. You can do that in almost any firm. It's a little painful because you have to have some perhaps awkward conversations.
Yep.
But it's all doable.
David, it looks like you say this all the time that that's the forcing function. Fixing the billing and how you charge clients forces you to do all the other stuff in your firm, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can have somebody actually size like what the impact of these changes are going to be, right? Like we can size moving to upfront payment or moving to annualized payment or moving to longer term payments. We can size that in the impact and then we can assess that back to what's the profit and then what's the value. I'm working on a project with Rightworks. We're launching end of April, home.exit.rightworks, where we're going to provide different types of valuations and recommendations on how to increase your value. And it's these kind of very practical, actionable things that they'll get. And the idea is to democratize the M&A and exit options for accounting and related professional service firms so that you don't have, so if you're $500,000 firm or $1 million tax practice, you can go out there and get real time feedback from buyers, lenders, M&A intermediaries on what's your value and not just what's your value, but tips, resources for benchmarking, for succession planning, for things that you can do in your business, connect with your peers, get real time feedback from buyers. Again, don't wait 5 years or don't wait till it's too late. Every 2 years, you should probably update your corporate development plan and understand where you're steering the business.
And if you're a $1 million firm, this could be $1 million in value. That's the spread we're talking about here in terms of whether you get that traditional, I'm going to buy your book of business kind of deal, or whether you get that modern digital firm deal with the higher multiple.
Yeah, and whether you're earning out your payout over 4 years or you're earning it out over 6 months or you're taking off some of the, I've talked to somebody this week who just, they're tired of doing the administration, sales and marketing. They just want somebody else to do that and her to focus on her key clients that she loves. You know, she's 62, she's not ready to retire, but she wants to get down that path and she just wants to hand off all that hassle. And that actually thinking about it that way, you can get higher total consideration than you would if you just exited today or you just wait till the last minute. So I think having that plan creates optionality.
Right.
And you can, increasing the valuation is good. Increasing the overall exit experience is more important.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting because a lot of these firms that are acquiring are short staffed already. So if you're willing to stick around and be a subject matter expert and service clients, then I guess that is kind of like, that's always been the most common sort of situation when you merge your small firm into a mid-sized firm. You become, for a few years, a service provider, and you're no longer managing the business, and then eventually you transition out. So knowing if you want to do that is really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, hey, Charles, thank you so much for your time today. We have been speaking with Charles Bedard, an M&A corporate development advisor for businesses. Charles, if people want to follow you online, get in touch with you, maybe they want to ask you for some of those tips, maybe a benchmark, where can they find you?
I'm at LinkedIn, Charles Bedard. I'm on X Twitter at Solving the Value. Love to connect.
Thanks so much. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you for having me, guys.